All right. We are... Oh, I just lost my place in my notes. That's all right. We have just been talking about the pre-exilic period. We've looked at five major milestones leading up to the exile in the Old Testament story, because we're looking at the story before the story of the New Testament. So we had the fall, covenant with Abraham, the Exodus, Sinai, the Promised Land, and we even looked at kind of the way in which the monarchy was birthed out of rebellion, although by God's grace, he will utilize it in order to develop a greater monarchy. So that's what we've been looking at so far. Now I want us to start switching into the exilic period. So if that was the pre-exilic period, what is the pre-exilic period referring to? The time period, what? Before the exile. So the exilic period is what? During the exile, or like the events right before and including, okay? So the exilic period, the exile is the antithesis of the Exodus. That's the way I would summarize the exile. It is the opposite of the Exodus. It's the antithesis. Now, I'm not going to get into the Hegelian synthesis, but that's a different issue. But the exile is the antithesis of the Exodus. Throughout the history of the people of Israel, God has been their rescuer. He's been the one delivering them out of oppression. But here in the exile, he will lead them into subjugation. I mean, everything that the Exodus was is in some sense being in their minds and in their hearts being reversed in the exile. As a matter of fact, Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 and through 2, I think it's probably one of the saddest, outside of maybe Genesis 3, one of the saddest portions in the entire Old Testament. I mean, it is depressing what he says here. And this is how the book begins. It says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, along with some of the articles from the temple." I mean, "these he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God." Whenever you read that, what are you hearing? What do you hear? Why is it that I say that's one of the most depressing passages? You have to read it with a different tone. This is not just giving information. What do you hear in that? Yeah, a loss of identity. Explain that. 100% agree. Yeah.
So those sacred artifacts that are carried away is basically an example of what they believe.
Absolutely. These artifacts are not just mere, they're not ornaments, they're not decoration. It's connected to their identity. We've talked about this. We're storied people. And they were constantly having the story retold and retold and retold because that forms who they are. And even the cultic vessels, even the vessels that they used inside of worship in the temple, and these were connected to promises. These were connected to covenants. This is their identity. And it says he besieges Jerusalem. You're talking the city that God loves. The intersection between heaven and earth where God's presence was dwelling with humanity. They besiege it, conquer it, and then carry off the vessels in the temple. Where do they put them?
In the treasury of their God.
Yeah. In the treasury, even in the worship contexts of the gods of Babylon. I mean, the part of the nation of Israel was intimacy through separation. We're separating ourselves from the nations as a means to actually reach back out to the nations. And now you have the nations conquering them. And from the Babylonian perspective, what's just happened? Yeah, Marduk has defeated Yahweh. And there's a part of it where you're looking at the Hebrews going, how do you argue with that? How do you argue with that? Whenever they came and besieged Jerusalem, Yahweh didn't deliver you. You're now having the very worship vessels that were set aside for Yahweh being worshipped in the temples of Marduk. You see the intensity of this? The exilic period, for everything that the Exodus was, the very first part of the new year. The I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. Everything that the Exodus was, the exile is the opposite. Same intensity, same depth of meaning. This is an overwhelming moment. Now, the natural question is, you know, well, multiple questions, you know, like, has God abandoned his people? Does this undo all? Did he break the covenant with Israel? Or why did this happen? These are the natural questions, but before we can answer why, we need to kind of take a couple of steps back and ask what? What happens leading up to? So, in your guys' time or your guys' study guide, you have what's called a timeline. I'm now going to start marching through the timeline. These dates and these events will be major oral exam questions. Does that make sense? Okay? If I have to explain that anymore, then communication is frivolous at that point. Okay, so God has a covenant with Israel. This is leading up. He has a covenant with Israel, promising both blessings and curses. I mean, that's Exodus chapters 19 through 24. If you do this, this will happen, and it's delightful, blessings. If you don't do this, this will happen, curses. Okay? Israel, from the time they received the covenant, are in constant rebellion. Constant rebellion. Even when they're receiving the law, they have to break the first set and re-get a new one. Constant rebellion. Then in 722, so we're in BCE or BC, whatever makes you most excited. 722 BC, the Assyrians destroy the northern kingdom, of Israel. Southern kingdom is Judah, northern kingdom, Israel. The Assyrians, A-S-S-Y-R-I-A-N-S, the Assyrians destroy the northern kingdom, which sends a pretty big message to the southern kingdom. I mean, God has been warning through his prophets that their rebellion would result in the curses of the covenant. If you rebel, you will have these consequences. And the northern and the southern kingdom both were relentless in their pursuit of rebellion. And finally, in 722, the Assyrians destroy the northern kingdom of Israel, giving Judah notice. This will happen to you as well. As a matter of fact, that's how Jeremiah 3:8 even starts off. What happened to the northern kingdom will happen to the southern if y'all don't repent. That's the message. And what happens? Judah doesn't repent. And it's not like God was quick to act. He delays around 100 years, allowing the southern kingdom to stay in their rebellion, but giving them opportunity to repent for 100 years. And then in 612... well, it isn't the exact date of their destruction, but the beginning of the southern kingdom's destruction begins. 612, the Assyrians defeat the Medo-Babylonian alliance. Medo, that this will be important. The Medes will be important later. There is a Medo-Babylonian alliance. A Medo-Babylonian alliance, and the Assyrians destroy that. That's big because a guy by the name of Nabopolassar, he gains independence for the Babylonians from the Medes. So this is an alliance, an awkward alliance. He gains independence. He is the dad of a guy named Nebuchadnezzar, which is kind of important for the southern kingdom's history. So Nabopolassar gains independence. Babylon is its own, and the emergence of Babylon is about ready to come. In 605, this date, tons of things happen in 605. So we're going to start with the first one. In 605, Nabopolassar dies. Which leaves the empire to his son Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? So Nabopolassar dies in 605. Nebuchadnezzar takes power. You want me to write his name up there? Will that help you? Nebuchadnezzar. What did I do? Oh, yeah. I was so excited about the second. Nebuchadnezzar. 605, Nebuchadnezzar dies. Nebuchadnezzar takes power. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in 605 as well, we're still in 605, he defeats the Egyptians. Which is a big deal, because Egypt also had a lot of what was called vassal kings or vassal kingdoms. Vassal's just a fancy word for, it's kind of like an extension of subjugated. In a treaty, this is probably more than what you want to know. In a treaty, you have what's called the suzerain, and you have a vassal. The vassal is the one that has no power, but because of the treaty, or because of a covenant, they receive some sort of benefit with the commitment. The suzerain is the one that has all of the power. That's even where you can even see the word suzerain is etymologically connected to the word sovereign. Okay? So the suzerain and the vassal, the Egyptians that he conquers, they're the suzerain of multiple treaties or multiple covenants with people. They have vassal kings. And one of the treaties or vassal kings is the southern kingdom. So whenever Nebuchadnezzar conquers the suzerain, he has a legitimate claim to all of the vassal kingdoms. Okay? So it's kind of like you destroy Egypt and then you inherit everything that they've already accomplished. So Nebuchadnezzar conquers Egypt, which means the southern kingdom now is an extension of Babylon. However, they don't really like that initially. So we're still in 605. He destroys the Egyptians and then comes up, notice in our map, okay, if this is the Mediterranean, obviously, Greece, Asia Minor. So then we have the Jordan River, which means Egypt is kind of down here-ish. He comes up, he conquers Egypt, and then comes up. This is Jerusalem, this is this region, okay? Which, Babylon's over here. I mean, the Tigris, Euphrates, Babylon's over here, all right? He comes up, though, and he lays siege to Jerusalem, 605. Lays siege to Jerusalem. I'm going to use a different color, because then I can write over the top. At the time of the siege, Jehoiakim, or you'll even see it sometimes with a K. Why? Because those are making the same sound. Jehoiakim, it's the M that's important. Jehoiakim is king, and Nebuchadnezzar decides he's going to leave Jehoiakim in Jerusalem as a vassal king of Babylon. So Nebuchadnezzar, after he sweeps up from Egypt, sieges Jerusalem, takes control, starts carrying away some people, some of the vessels, not all of them necessarily. Well, because that happens in about 20 years. But Nebuchadnezzar ends up deciding, we're going to leave Jehoiakim as a vassal king. You're going to be subjugated to me, but you're going to rule over this territory for me. Okay? About a couple of years later. It's kind of a little bit shady. Anywhere from 605 to like 597, around this region. So after Nebuchadnezzar leaves, we'll even just say 604 to 597. Jehoiakim decides to revolt. So that'll be a theme, especially once we get into the Maccabean revolt and all that stuff. Jehoiakim, though, decides to revolt. Nebuchadnezzar obviously is not going to respond to that well. So he's going to come and deal with Jehoiakim. Before he can, Jehoiakim dies. Jehoiakim dies, leaving his son, Jehoiakim, which is the reason why that M is so important, because now it's an N, leaving his son Jehoiakim. How do you know which is which? Just keep them in alphabetical order and then you'll be fine. Jehoiakim takes power at the age of 18. Yep. What have you done lately? You know what I mean? He takes power, and in 598, 597, around this date, Jehoiakim, he surrenders to Babylon. He's like, I don't know what my dad was doing. Sorry about that. Oh, I don't know what's going on there either. He's like, I don't know what he was doing, but we're not fighting you. I surrender. But Babylon's not going to respond to it well. One of the things, if you're an empire, especially if you're trying to expand, what you can't have is these constant mini rebellions. You need subjugation. Otherwise, it threatens the stability of your entire empire. So you're going to do that through a multitude of ways, whether it be through fear or brute force or propaganda. You're going to do a lot of different things. One of the things you're not going to do is to allow a rebellion, even if there is a surrender. You're not going to allow a rebellion to go unpunished. There's no way. So what do they do? Well, a couple of things. First of all, Jehoiakim is taken into captivity, along with actually Ezekiel at this time. But they're going like, no, we're not going to have one of your lineage even being here to lay claim to the throne. And at this time too, you have the beginnings of some of the cultic vessels. There's a part of it too where you have to figure out what is it that people are rallying around. If you're an empire, sometimes the difficult thing is okay, what's unifying them? Something is, but it's not always easy to see. And eventually they figure out what it is it's their religion. Because you have a little bit more of some skirmishes until 586, 587. That's the next date I want you to know. 86, 87, but since we're in BC, we're going backwards. 587, 586. You have the destruction of the temple. The decimation of Jerusalem. It's completely wiped out. Mass deportations also occur in this date. Mass deportations. Why divide and conquer? That's why. I mean, why in the world would you allow a group of people to continue to stay in one location whenever all they do is bind themselves together and then fight against you? One of the best things that you could do is to take a big portion of them away, move them, and even take some of your people and move them in. Then it's going to, the allegiances of towards Babylon will be disseminated into the people that have been constantly raging against Babylon. You're going to mass deport them. Destroy their locus of power, their locus of unity. Which is why cultic vessels will be also marched into the temples of Marduk. Going back to Daniel 1, 1 through 2. And that's the story of Daniel. Daniel's one of the ones that's taken in the mass deportation. Well, you've got to be kidding me. Just, there we go. Okay. He's one of the ones that's taken. Why? Because you're also going to take their wisest and their best leaders, and you're going to bring them into their court. Because if you can convert them, then they become influential on all the other people. But you're not going to leave them, the wisest and the great leaders, back in the same place that's been giving you revolts. It doesn't make any sense politically. No way. If they've been giving you promise for 20 years, you got to figure out a way to crush this, or it could destabilize your whole empire. And so 587, 586 is finally them saying, enough's enough. Tired of this. We're wiping your city out. Sending a message. Now, timeline break. We need to talk through some stuff, okay? We're going to do this from time to time. I'm going to lead you through a couple events, and then we're going to summarize and even process this, okay? Timeline break. There are five key developments during the exile, during this time period, that are quite significant for the nation of Israel. Let's remind ourselves, though. Why are we talking about this?
Story before the story.
We're trying to build the atmosphere, the environment, the society, the sociology, the cultural milieu of the Gospels. That's why. Okay? Five major developments. Number one, the promised land is lost. There is a zeal, a desire to return back to the land, all of the exiles in the Gospels, and it's very intense. But the promised land has been lost. They no longer have possession of the land or control of the land that was promised to Moses. That was a key part of their identity, of their covenant. The covenant was not just a temple. It was not just a ritual. The covenant was promised or was solidified by land. And now they no longer have control of it. But put yourself in the lens of a group of people that have a land that is promised to them, that is their own, and then overnight it is taken away. I mean, right now, like if we were looking out these windows, and let's just pretend the blinds were open, and you looked out there and it no longer was America. It no longer was the country you grew up in, but it was some other country has come in and invaded, and now you are a vassal kingdom. The signs no longer are in English. The symbols no longer are what you're familiar with. There's something about that that would, well, I mean, honestly, just put yourself in the positions of the Native Americans for a moment, just a moment. And what does that do? Whenever the land that you're going, well, I mean, this is where we used to get our food, but now, I mean, this is where my kids grew up here, my great-great-grandfather, he settled there, I mean, but now, it's one of the reasons why I'm going like, gosh, I don't understand why we don't understand the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I don't understand how we don't understand this. Because I'm going like, yeah, I mean, we all talk about in celebratory terms how Israel was founded as a nation in 1948 after World War II. But here's my pushback on that. Founded as a nation, but isn't it also, don't we need to also recognize the fact that where they were founded, people had been living in those locations for hundreds, even thousands of years? Overnight, 800,000 Palestinians were removed from Israel and deported to Jordan. 800,000 in order for that land to be given to Israel. I'm going, and you don't understand why there's conflict? It's like, my goodness, it's only been 50, 60 years since this has happened. And you think it's just going to be forgotten like this? And when I mean hundreds of years, I mean hundreds of years the Palestinians had been living in that region. Hundreds of years. And they were hospitable initially to the Jewish people that were moving into the region. And overnight, they lose their land. And the world not only celebrates it, but enforces it. And you wonder why they're mad? Matter of fact, there's a book called The Cleansing of Palestine by Elin Pape, who at the time was a journalist for what is now the Nation of Israel. Now he's an outcast and even somewhat of a fugitive because he's like, I'm going to write what really happened because I was there. And he talks about how entire cities of Palestinian people that had welcomed the Jews into the land, their cities were wiped out, and in the rubble of their houses, grenades, live grenades were placed, mines were placed, so that if people went back to get some of their stuff as they were being kicked out of the land, it would blow them up. And you're going, what happens to you when you lose a land that's been in your family for generations? And I mean that from the nation of Israel's perspective too, here in the story of Babylon. What happens? It's not forgotten quickly, I can promise you that. And there's a disorientation, a desperation that's infused in the very fabric of your being. And you see this come out even in Psalms. Psalm 137. Listen to what is the request in this psalm. By the rivers of Babylon. By the rivers of Babylon. Not by the river. By the rivers of Babylon. We sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, not to play anymore. Because it's one of those things, like, how can you sing when you're in a foreign land. For there our captors asked us for songs. What a jerk thing to do. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? I mean, the intensity of this moment, of this date, when they lose the promised land, when it is stripped away from them, is not something that just goes away easy. It's a part of the fabric of their identity. And there's an intensity to their pain that doesn't go away quickly. I mean, and I think that's actually a part of our country's problem even today. I genuinely think that we would understand a lot of the division that's happening today if we would realize the significance of some of the events that have occurred to the people groups that are trying to voice their dissent, their frustration. It's like, yeah, the things that have happened in the past 100 years may not have affected you or your race or your position, but the ones that it has, read Psalm 137 for a moment and reflect. Just reflect. Remember, history at its best, frankly, ministry at its best, is whenever you know how to be empathetic, putting on the flesh of the people that are not like you. It's like, you know, I mean, honestly, even like the best profs are the ones that remember what it's like to be a student. The best minister is the one that it's like to remember to be sitting in the pew, struggling with finances, struggling with the job loss, struggling with wounds that frankly no one else can see and no one else seems to care about. If you really want to do the history well, we have to also allow the timeline to come alive with emotions that are pretty intense. Their land is gone. And it was the land that established them as the people of God. Now who are they? Is this making sense? Yeah, question or comment?
So did they have these thoughts of their land being gone when they were deported or when they were a vassal kingdom to Babylon?
Well, that's a great question, because what it does is it forces us to take us into their perspective even deeper. Because there's a part of it where I'm going, I don't blame him. Why would he rebel if being a vassal king of Babylon is totally cool? If he's like, we're subjugated, but at least we have Babylon. Like, this is kind of even the myth of Rome. And what are people upset about? Rome gives them all kinds of good stuff. Like, that even happens today. Why would people upset if America's invading inside of the Middle East? I mean, we give freedom and liberty. And I'm going, well,
but what if they don't want what we're selling? What if they want their stuff? Like, what then? Like, genuinely, it's like, son, eat the ice cream. It's good. What if he wants a different flavor of ice cream? Then my gift is actually a punishment. Just depends on whose eyes you're looking through.
So Jehoiakim becomes a vassal king. He's a vassal king of Egypt on some level. And now he's a vassal king of Babylon. Is it any better? Or just a different flavor of ice cream that you hate? Like, there's a part of this that even whenever the Jews, quote unquote, have a, you know, King Herod, and we're like, come on, at least you have some independence. At least some? You know, it's kind of this weird struggle. Americans struggle with this deeply. We don't empathize well. We don't stop and think, maybe people don't want democracy. Well, who wouldn't want democracy? I mean, you get your own. Communal societies don't understand individuality the way that we celebrate it and even worship it. What they are committed to is belonging. Not having a voice. The voice is the community. And there's parts of that that, frankly, I find quite beautiful. And there's parts of it that I also lament, going, but But why would I lament it? It's because from my perspective, what we have is valuable. But what if somebody came in here and said, nope, we're going to do a communal society. No one has a voice. There's a part of that you'd feel like you've lost something of your very identity. But whenever we do that, that's like, you know, even the mantra of the last 15 years, we're spreading freedom and liberty and democracy. And I'm going, but what if people don't want democracy? What if they're okay with a king and a queen? What if they're okay with a dictator? Why is it that our form of freedom is what we're selling and not just something, you know, there's a part of it where I'm going, oh, it's because we're not empathizing. So we don't understand why people won't go out and vote in these countries. We assume it's because they're afraid. Or maybe it's because they don't find value in that. What if that's the case? You know, it's kind of like a missionary that goes into an unformed people group and he forces them to adopt our hymns and isn't okay with them writing their own songs. It's like, no, you don't give them American Christianity, you give them Christ. And it's okay if it is a Christ that in some sense is colliding with their culture and looks way different than yours in some places. And I mean some places because I'm going, there are places I won't compromise on that, like who is Jesus and what did he accomplish? But it's okay. We do this with our culture, but we don't understand it why people wouldn't want to just take exactly what we're giving them. It's kind of like, for example, and I'm having somebody paint this for me, and a lot of it's from my son. But it's like, I've actually heard people get upset whenever they have seen paintings of a black Jesus. Like, why are you upset at that? I'm having a painting done for my office of a black Jesus. And there's a part of it because I'm going, I want my youngest son to realize when you look at Jesus, you should see yourself. I don't care what color you are. He is. Period. He is. But I'm going like, but we have no problem when there's a bunch of white Jesuses around. He wasn't white either. But I don't have a problem with that either, because what we're trying to do is to see our image in the one that we love. So I'm going, so allow people to see themselves in Christ. That's a holy thing. I don't understand this. But we're not just a lot of times selling Christ. We're selling our version of it, and we don't know why everybody doesn't want it. Well, maybe because Christ wants to meet them on their terms and not yours. Same thing is true even with this. Vassal king is no better than exile. It's no different. Because they're still not in control of the promised land, which is why a rebellion of Jehoiakim ends up being launched, even though it was ultimately a failure. Vassal king is still not freedom, which is why whenever Rome is in power, the exile has not ended. The exile is going on. In other words, what's happening here at the 6th century BCE does not end. Does not end. In some senses, Jews don't believe that the exile has ever ended. And I mean that, even Josephus and the way that Philo is talking about is the exile is not over, and many Jews, rabbis today even would say, no, the exile is not over. It's the reason why they actually reject Jesus. Matter of fact, it's the Zionist movement that's trying to push all of the Palestinians because they don't believe the exile has ended. They believe it will end, and they're going to see to it. But no, in many ways, the presence of God never returns unless you see the incarnation of Christ as the presence of God. And the promised land really was never meant to be just a sliver of land. It was meant to be the entire earth, which is different. But you realize the loss of the land is kind of a big deal. Is this making sense? Which is just like the second one. The monarchy is gone. Key developments, five key developments. Loss of the land. Number two, monarchy is gone. That's kind of a big deal whenever I read 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 through 16. This is Nathan talking to David. King David, listen to the language. The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over, David, and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Notice that word forever. Kind of a big deal. I will be his father and he will be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with a rod wielded by men, with floggings inflicted by human hands. But my love will never be taken away from him, as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. What happens here? You see why that's an important question? What happens here? That promise is in jeopardy, yeah? You said forever. Where is Jehoiakim? He's in Babylon. How can he have a kingdom that's established forever whenever they don't even have a king sitting on the throne? Oh, and they wrestle with that in the Psalms. Psalms is a beautiful book because it actually allows people to be real. Psalm 89, 38. But you have rejected, you have spurned, you have been angry, very angry with your anointed one. You have renounced the covenant with your servant and have defiled his crown in the dust. Mercy. You have broken through all his walls and reduced his strongholds to ruins. All who pass by have plundered him. He has become the scorn of his neighbors. You have exalted the right hand of his foes. You have made all his enemies rejoice. Indeed, you have turned back the edge of his sword and have not supported him in battle. Who's on trial here? You have put an end to his splendor and cast his throne to the ground. You have cut short the days of his youth. You have covered him with a mantle of shame. How long, O Lord? Will you hide yourself forever? How long will your wrath burn like fire? Remember how fleeting is my life. For what futility you have created all humanity. Who can live and not see death? Or who can escape the power of the grave? Ah, Jesus. Lord, where is your former great love, which in your faithfulness you swore to David? Remember, Lord, how your servant has been mocked. How I bear in my heart the taunts of all the nations, the taunts with which your enemies, Lord, have mocked, with which they have mocked every step of your anointed one. Loss of a monarchy? Kind of a big deal. Because notice what they're equating. It's not just a loss of identity. This is what they're equating. They're equating the loss of the promised land, the cross of the monarchy, or the loss of the monarchy, with the abandonment of Yahweh. He has left them. How can we sing songs of joy on the banks of a foreign land? Why? Because you sing songs of joy and adoration and praise and worship whenever you're receiving what it is that you feel obligated to. You know what I mean? But their monarchy is gone, so what now? Did David not matter? They also begin to grapple with the loss of religion. I mean, my goodness, it's a big deal to lose the land and the monarchy. But now they don't have the temple. Now they can't do sacrifices. They can't have their festivals like the Passover. They can't have an atonement sacrifice for the sins of the people. There are no priests, no high priest. I mean, it's a big deal to lose a land and to lose a king, but to lose the very soul of your people? This is what Daniel is praying about in Daniel chapter 9, verse 20. What do we do? What do we do with the sins of Israel that are piling up if we are not even able to offer a sacrifice in the ways that you've laid out to absolve them of their sins? What do we do? Will the sins just heap up forever and you will damn our entire nation? How do we deal with the problem of separation with you when we have no place to worship you? So what ends up developing, number four, is a new, like, we'll call it an exilic Jewish religion. Now, it's not going to be completely different, but it is going to be significantly different. With no ability to do sacrifices or festivals, no priests, what ends up developing is an exilic Jewish religion that comes with three key components. Number one, the Sabbath becomes essential. Why? Because you can keep the Sabbath no matter where you are. You don't need a place to keep the Sabbath. All you need to do is to obey the commandment to not work. It separates you from the culture, even though you may not be in the place that was promised to you. So Sabbath. Again, why are we talking about this? Story before the story. Number two, what do you do in the exile? You keep kosher. Your dietary laws become essential to retain your identity. What you eat matters. Don't eat like the pagans. This is Daniel chapter 1. Willing to be put to the test for 10 days, that I will not eat any of the foods of the courts of Babylon, but I will eat what I've been commanded to eat. And after that, God proves faithful because they are more strong, they are more sharp, they are more wise than all of the people inside of the Babylonian courts. So what do? The exilic Jewish religion, its Sabbath is emphasized because you can do that anywhere. Kosher eating, dietary laws, you can do that anywhere. You don't need a temple to keep eating the right foods. And number three, circumcision. Circumcision. It's the mark of the covenant that sets them apart from the pagan culture. We will continue to circumcise our children. Now think about this. Those three things, this is how they retain some vestige of their identity in exile. Where do those three things come up? Here, what are the major... Two out of the three of those are major controversies with Jesus, are they not? What is he doing on the Sabbath? Healing people, doing things that are unlawful. Remember, his disciples are caught rubbing grain in their hands, harvesting on the Sabbath, and he gets attacked. The man with the shriveled hand is put inside the synagogue, and Jesus' compassion overwhelms, and he heals the man, and he gets accused of breaking the Sabbath. And Jesus says, what about the Sabbath? It was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. I am the Lord of the Sabbath, he says. The Sabbath, if he's breaking it, in some sense, it's even destroying a part of what allowed them to have an identity in the exile. Same thing with dietary laws. It's not what you put in your mouth that makes you unclean. It's what comes out of your mouth. In Mark's gospel, it says, saying that, he made all foods clean. I mean, think about Acts chapter 10. The sheet that comes down with Peter, and it's all... Why is it that dietary laws were so important to the Pharisees? Is it because they're legalists? No. It's because that's what allowed them to retain some shred of dignity in an exile. Why is circumcision such a big deal in Acts 15? To say, you don't need to be circumcised anymore, loses your identity. And it, in some sense, eradicates what they thought was the only other way of looking at a covenantal promise. It's over. Which is why Paul has to deal with this in Romans. Has God just forgotten his promises and abandoned Israel? No. He's fulfilled them greater than even if we had the temple rebuilt. You were back in the land. You kept all the laws, the Sabbath, the kosher. He has exceeded them with Christ. But you can see why it meant so much to them. Because when you're in exile, what you're doing is you're trying to retain a shred of dignity. At least a morsel of identity. And these three things were the ways in which they were able to calcify inside of a complete devastation. To attack these three things is to attack everything. Because the exile basically stripped it all away anyway. We'll get to the fifth one tomorrow. Love you guys. See you in the morning.